Hello, I'm Rob Beckett.
And I'm Josh Whittaker.
Welcome to Parent in Hell, the show in which Josh and I discuss what it's really like to be a parent, which I would say can be a little tricky.
So, to make ourselves, and hopefully you, feel better about the trials and tribulations of modern-day parenting, each week we'll be chatting to a famous parent about how they're coping.
Or hopefully how they're not coping.
And we'll also be hearing from you, the listener, with your tips, advice, and, of course, tales of parenting woe.
Because let's be honest, there are plenty of times when none of us know what we're doing. Hello, you're listening to Parent in Hell with...
Can you say Rob Beckett?
Rob Beckett.
Can you say Josh Whittaker?
Josh Whittaker.
Good boy, well done.
There we go.
Nice one.
Hello and welcome. This is Ezra from Leeds, 22 months, saying Rob and Josh's names after recording. He clapped himself and said, well done. I started listening last summer when I was digging out the back of the garden so we could fit in a large climbing frame. My wife started listening after hearing me laugh out loud. We now make sure we save up episodes if we're driving from Leeds to Kent to see my family. Rob, I'm from Tonbridge.
Ooh, Tonbridge. I like Tonbridge.
Is that different to Tonbridge Wells?
Right, so bone of contention. Royal Tunbridge Wells and then Tonbridge. So Royal Tunbridge Wells thinks a little bit of itself.
Yeah, I bet it does.
And it looks down its little snooty nose at Tonbridge.
Does it?
Don't get me wrong, Royal Tunbridge Wells, it's fine. Nice place. Tonbridge, yeah. Nice place. But Tonbridge, don't mind being confused with Royal Tunbridge Wells. Royal Tunbridge Wells does not like people saying it's the same place, Josh. It's a 20-minute drive away, and they get very particular about it. They also have one of the hardest gigs in the country.
Oh, my God.
Royal Tunbridge Wells, that old church.
It's such a tough gig.
Yeah, it's a very tough gig. Different places. Places for different needs. Now, Josh, exciting news. We should tell the listeners this.
Yes.
Because we do have listeners.
Yeah, well, a certain group of listeners who live in a certain place.
Yes. Don't worry, it's a positive message. We're not banning you from listening. Yeah. We are doing Parenting Hell live in Dubai. It's an international tour now, Josh. We've added one day abroad.
It's an international tour, bloody hell, with like fucking the Rolling Stones or U2.
I do enjoy that when you see comedians that put in one Helsinki date and they go, am I in my world tour starting? You're like, it's not a world tour.
Dublin. Yeah. My world tour begins.
Well, Wales is a separate country, actually, so Cardiff counts.
Yeah.
So we are doing Dubai. So you can buy tickets for that somewhere, Josh, can't you?
Social media channels? Should I say those words confidently, Rob?
Social media channels.
Is that the kind of thing people say these days?
We'll put a link out on Instagram as well. And if you just find it, I think is it the Dubai Opera House? I'm not sure, but
it is.
If you Google it, you'll find
it'll be the highest culture they've ever had in that opera house, mate. Here we go. It was built for opera, but this is what you really bloody want.
It was the first show after the pandemic in that opera house, and I think that's what they wanted when they built it. But yeah, if you want to come, if you live in Dubai,
but you were doing Carmen, weren't you?
Yeah, it's one of our favourites, actually, Carmen. Yeah, so if you want to come and see us in Dubai, if you live in Dubai, you live in Abu Dhabi, travel over. We're doing that in July, aren't we?
Yeah,
July the 3rd.
Yeah, that's probably it as well, isn't it? That'll probably be the last time we do the show.
I think so, yeah.
So if you live anywhere and you're like, I've got to see this show, that's your chance. Or the other thing is, if you're really desperate to see the show and you don't want to go to Dubai, we're in Birmingham tonight.
Yeah, see you then.
Right, let's get on with our guest.
I'm very excited about this.
Yeah.
We have got the biggest name we've ever, ever had on the podcast. We have got Olympic gold medalist, two-time world heavyweight champion boxer, businessman, the man that brought you the George Foreman lean, mean, grilling machine. This man's lived the life, Josh, and I think...
He has.
Absolutely nothing to do with us being exhausted from the tour with nothing left in the tank. I think we should just get straight into the interview.
Just get him on. Sometimes you just get him on because people don't want to hear us blabbering on.
Exactly. Shut the fuck up, lads. Get on George Foreman. This is Big George Foreman. Hello, George.
Hello, George.
Hello, everybody.
Thank you so much for doing this.
I'm happy to be with you.
This week, we are joined by a megastar, the best, biggest guest we've ever had. It's George Foreman. Big George Foreman, two times heavyweight champion of the world, businessman, now filmmaker. George, thank you so much for doing this. We're really excited and a bit nervous, if we're totally honest.
Well, I'm happy to be with you and talk about the movie and life and children.
And so how was it doing a movie where watching someone play you must be a really strange experience, right? Is it difficult not to go, that wasn't how it was. That wasn't how the scene was.
No, the actor Chris Davis, he did so well. Sometime I thought when it was over, I believed he was George Foreman. But it was a good story about getting up, brushing off your pants, spitting in your palms, and going another round.
Well, George, your life has been, you know, I thought I knew about you from the boxing and stuff like that, but when I was sort of researching you, you've lived about seven lives. So if I've missed anything, let me know. But Olympic champion, then you went into boxing professionally and become world champion. Then you stopped, run a community youth club centre and became a preacher. And then when you needed more money for the youth club, you went back into boxing, became heavyweight champion again.
In your 40s.
And then obviously the George Foreman lean mean grilling machine took off and became one of the most popular and successful things ever. And then I've just found out you did the Masked Singer last year. When does it stop, George?
When does it stop? But it's been such a good journey in my life. I've had a lot of disappointments, been knocked down a few times, but most importantly, I've been on faith and I was on my way.
And do you find that with your faith, that feels like the biggest turning point in your life in a way, right? When you almost died, you died and then you got faith from that, right?
That's right. Dead and alive, in a split second, my whole life changed. For 10 years, I didn't make a fist. I didn't box. I walked away from it, trying to figure out what in the world has happened to me. And then along the way, I started the youth center, started helping kids. I ran out of money.
Kids will do that to you.
And I'm happy boxing was there. It gave me a second chance to keep that youth center going, to keep me. And then I'm a grandfather as well. 10 kids I raised. I became better at their homework than they were.
10 kids.
And 15 grandkids.
15 grandkids. And so are you doing any of the babysitting then with the grandkids? It's a bit difficult for them to choose which one to bring over, right?
Well, when you have so many grandkids, it's been a lovely thing to watch them grow, for someone to know you. And they only know me as Grandpa George, but the movie made them find out different things, answer a lot of questions about my life. It was good for them.
And your kids, you've got, so 10 kids you've got. And is it correct that all the boys are called George? Is that correct?
Yeah, five sons, George Foreman, each one.
Amazing.
I told my wife, if I forget one of my kids' names, a boy's name, I want to stop boxing. So I took care of that.
How does that work day to day when there's six Georges in the room? How are you talking to each other?
Well, and not only that, there are about two more Georges' grandkids. That's not my fault there, though. They did it themselves. But, you know, my wife, whatever tone of voice, when she said George, for some reason, we all know who she's talking to.
How do the kids talk to each other? Are they got different names? Are they all George? Are they like George 2, George 3?
Yeah, they call themselves George. One is, as you mentioned, numbers. But and some of them have nicknames. But for some reason, they're really happy about it. They have the same name. They love it.
And amazing. I think I've heard before that you, is it true that you gave them that name so you all had something together, like a bond, because you met your biological father later in life, and so was it important for you to have that bond early doors with your kids?
Yeah, I didn't meet my biological father. I think I was a grown man, had been champion, lost the title, become a preacher, and then I met my father for the first time. I wanted to make certain all my boys would have something in common, all of my children. And it's something no one could take away from them. And why not give them a good name?
And so when you were training for for boxing in your first stint, do you have names for the first and second stint? Is it the old George or the new George? Or is it just the first and second go at it?
Yeah, well, the movie tells my whole life, the first and even the second time when I became heavyweight champion of the world again, 20 years later.
Wow.
And so I went at it the first time. All I had was crushing power and a lot of hate. And I stopped boxing for 10 years, found faith. I had to come back to boxing, but this time there was never a punch in anger.
Really?
I learned a new sport, a new style.
Was it more rewarding the second time then because you were in a better place mentally? You wasn't so angry. Would you enjoy it? Was you present more?
The first time around, it was like our dream. We all dream of doing big things, but that dream became a nightmare because I was champion of the world, a wealthy young man, but I didn't find peace and happiness that I thought I would. It was a nightmare. But the second time around, I had all of that peace and happiness, a reason to fight, not just for fame and fortune. I found good reason, and it made me more happy than the first time. It really did.
And what do you think's more difficult, winning the heavyweight world championship or looking after 10 kids?
I tell you, that journey of raising 10 kids, you better be heavyweight champion of the world in reality. You better know something because it was a challenge. Raising each child was different. You got to make certain. I had to make certain that I didn't try to get them mixed up.
Yeah.
Each child had their own life. Some would hide their homework. They had homework. They'd hide it under the bed. But then the teacher was called me. I had to visit schools and PTA meetings. Oh. That was a job.
Yeah. What's the gap between the oldest and the youngest?
My oldest child, of course, probably 50 years old. And my youngest, about 23. I used to tease him. I said to the oldest one, I said, they're going to call you aunt. The oldest daughter, they're going to call you their aunt. And they laughing. But you know what? The youngest became the most adult of them all.
Wow.
You say, like, you're called in for PTA meetings and stuff. How much are people going, that's George Foreman? Surely the teacher's also going, I'm not going to take this guy on. He's heavyweight world champion. Yeah.
And that was, and the one thing about my children, most of them, they really knew me as just dad. I stopped boxing to raise my children. And they grew up, all of them grew up knowing me just as dad. When I came back to boxing, that was a strange episode for them because they saw me in another light.
Yeah.
But most of them had already seen me as just dad.
That must have been weird.
Yeah, because you did it the opposite way to most athletes, where most athletes dedicate their life to their sport and they get to 40-odd when they make, or 38 and they retire, and the kids have all grown up and left. But you took the middle part out, which most people say that's a terrible decision, you're at your peak, and you managed to spend all that time with your kids and get the best of both worlds by going back to boxing. So that 10 years, did you really appreciate that then? And do you feel like you've got a much stronger bond with your kids now than you would have if you hadn't had that 10-year break?
I'm so happy I had a chance to enjoy my kids, raise them, and they know me as just dad. We bonded. And the 10 years that I was out of boxing, I learned to take them to the beach, go into the amusement parks. Oh, man, I had a great time just raising kids. It was hard for me to get back into boxing because of it. Didn't know how to leave them and go and get on the road again.
How did they react to watching you get punched? Like, that must have been a really weird experience for them to watch you. Did they come to the fights?
Yeah, it's strange. I saw them all at one of my boxing matches way back in Reno, Nevada.
Yeah.
And they were enjoying themselves prior to the match. But once they saw the fight, I remember them saying, I'm not going back again ever. They stayed out. They'd be afraid. I fought for the title. I heard stories about them running into the shower and trying to get away from it. They didn't want to hear it. But they were happy I became champion of the world. But they weren't ready to see me box. I can tell you that.
Were they more fans of the grilling machine than the boxing?
Oh, boy. George has his grill, but George has two. On and on and on. But they love the grill. Even to this day, becoming adults, they have their George Foreman grill.
I mean, you could never have imagined how big that would go. You know, they mentioned it in the film as well. But, like, it, you know, I think there'll be people that know you from the grill more than the boxing in certain places, you know, non-boxing fans. But did you ever imagine it would become as popular?
I used the grill. It was my wife who used it because I started a joint venture. We're looking for a product. And my wife had it and was using it, but I didn't particularly like it. But she convinced me, Joy, this thing really worked, because I love the burgers, of course. And you make the burgers, they were still juicy. The grease would go out, but it was still juicy. And I thought, boy, I'm going to have 16 of those things, one for my aunt, one for my cousins, and then my wife. I had no idea that it would sell over 120 million of those things worldwide.
Whoa.
It was a shock to me. I didn't see that coming.
Of all your kids, like, how different are they? Because, like, we've got two kids each, and you can see the different personalities. Can you see yourself in all of them? Like, is it weird in that way?
When they pop up, I do see myself in each of them. When they pop up, see one, you see the other. But it's not like you have any more than two kids. You have 10, but not like you have any more than just two kids, because if one's missing, your heart is broken. You can't say this one's going to take the place of the other. The experience is you just loved them all as one.
When you had your first grandkid, what was that like?
Now, that was really scary, having grandkids. I was a grandpa and heavyweight champion of the world at the same time. What's going on here?
Yeah, imagine, can you pick him up from school, George? No, I can't. I've got to go and fight Evander Holyfield, actually, next week. Sorry.
I'm telling you, and that's what an experience to be heavyweight champ of the world and waiting in line just like all the other parents, picking up grandkids, not just kids, but picking up grandkids.
And so you're really hands-on parent then, because it would be easy, like, obviously, to go, I'm focusing on boxing and stuff, but you love that hands-on experience of it.
Yeah, and what an experience to be a dad, because you go through life trying to become rich and famous, coming out, but you find out the best things in life, I can't say are free, but the best thing in life doesn't cost a dime, just time with your children and grandkids. Yeah. That's the best.
And when you first, you know, burst onto the scene, like you said, you was very angry and aggressive and ambitious. Was that who you were, or was it you playing a role to sort of, like, establish yourself? Because you're obviously way more relaxed and funny and charismatic, where before you were just big, scary George and focused. Was that a character you were playing?
You pick up bad habits as you go along. And the big habit I had, I was angry. When I decided I wanted to be heavyweight champ of the world, my best friend, well, my stablemate and friend was Sonny Liston, who had been champ of the world. And he was mean to everybody. And I thought, that's where you got to be. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I became more upset than him. I think he looked at me a few times to say, ease up, man. But you pick up a lot of anger. It's really easy to pick up anger, and you want revenge on so many people. And that's what made life really rough for me.
And when you had your kids, did that change your outlook on things? Like, I can imagine you as a very caring father. I can't imagine you being like a stern kind of angry dad.
Boy, I tell you, kids took a lot of hate away from me. To love some, for the first time in my life having kids, I found people that I loved, and nothing could come between us. That changes everything. See them smile, make them laugh. The kids look at me as a big joker. Even my grandkids to this day, they think, oh, he's joking again. And that's the most lovely part of my life, is experiencing raising children.
Was that one of the reasons you did the Masked Singer last year? Was that because of, like, your kids and your grandkids? That's a really such a popular show with young people.
Yeah, it was my wife. She'd been watching it for ages. They've been after me for over a year. Come on, do the show. But I wouldn't. But she convinced me, George, I want you to do it. She enjoyed it. So I did it. And come to find out, hey, I can sing. So now the next thing is to do an album.
Oh, yes. Why not?
If you don't buy that album.
So when did you have your first child? Had you found your faith at this point, or did you have kids before you found your faith? When was your first child born?
Yeah, I had my child when I found Jesus Christ. My first child had already become like 4 years old. Mm. So they don't even know me, even to this day, as anything but Daddy the Preacher.
Yeah. And do you think is it almost unlocked a sort of fearlessness inside you to go, you know, you had this faith now and you lost this anger and you sort of, it was almost like you was liberated from what you were before. And I think when you are liberated, you have a freedom to do anything, and you wanted to be a preacher and then do the youth club. Do you feel that that is sort of more powerful than the strength and anger inside? It's a much more positive energy that you found.
A great description. Liberated I was. All of a sudden, I had real, what you call, courage. And it takes a lot of courage to be kind and love people, because you think, hey, what's going to happen to me if I love this person? I really found courage to love my fellow man. And that night in Puerto Rico where I died in this vision, I was dead and alive again. I had a second chance to live, found out the greatest invention of all time, not the grill, but human beings.
That, is the grill the second greatest?
Yeah, but human beings, man, I love them. I've not met anyone in my life to this day that I didn't care about and wanted to be kind to them. And that's what that experience did. Once you have a second chance to live, it changes everything.
For people, because obviously that's a key part in the film, is that moment. But for people who aren't aware of that, talk us through that near-death experience.
Yeah, I had been heavyweight champ of the world and on top of the world. Then I lost the title to Muhammad Ali. I became, even more angry. And I wanted revenge. I wanted to become champ of the world again. But one night after a boxing match, when I was number one contender, I found God in the dressing room. That experience, I was dead and alive in a split second, over my head, under my feet. There was nothing, hopelessness. If someone tell you to swim in the sea and there's nowhere to go, that's the way it was. And then I said, I don't care if there is death, I still believe there's a God. When I said that, rescued from nothing. I saw blood on my forehead and on my hand, and I screamed, Jesus Christ is coming alive in me. Oh, they rushed me to intensive care. I can tell you that. I was in a hospital looking at that button go bing, bing, bing. And I knew if it had gone flat, that was the end of me. And but that changed me. Like I said, for 10 years, I didn't box. I couldn't make reckoning. I couldn't understand that. I didn't believe religion existed. But I walked away from that day. With religion, and then later on, I found faith in God. I couldn't change. The best thing that ever happened to me was finding God.
And how quickly was that change then? Obviously, you had that moment where you saw something, and then you was in the hospital. Was it like a light switch going on, or did you, over time, it sort of, you know, the way you was thinking about things, your outlook changed?
Yeah, right in that hospital, I said, I just got hit too hard. Maybe something this, maybe that. You try to talk your way out of it, but the smell of death, I've never forgotten. I couldn't talk myself out of that. I was dead and given a second chance. The first thing you want to do is go home and tell your mom, hey, I love you. Because when I was dying, it was like the only thing that bothered me, I hadn't said goodbye to my mother, who had put up with so much. So I got a chance to go back home, spend time with my mother, embrace the life with children. And that changed me instantly. Well, I guess in a matter of, a week, I had to find a new joy for me and learn to live with him. It disappointed a lot of people because they loved the champ at that time. But the champ was gone. That night I died literally, and that was the end of the old boxer. A new one was born. Took me 10 years to get to know him.
It's amazing that, like, this, it's such an incredible story. It's amazing it's taken this long to be made into a film, because you read, you know, your life story and you go, well, this is more, incredible than any film in a way. Have you been considering this for years? How did it come about?
Well, a lot of people talked about it, and the opportunity would come and go, but once the people at Affirm and Sony Pictures decided to do it, we got a script, something I can live with. Because if you're a celebrity, like, well, some of us are, you hide your life. You go through life with big gates around your house so nobody can come in, tinted glass on your cars, dog glasses. You go through life hiding your life, go through times. Now it was time to reveal. I wrote a book, and it was time to reveal. And it's not easy to go out and tell your story to the whole world. They see things that you thought, I thought that was a secret. That's not easy. I'm telling you, it's not something you go back and say, yay. You say, boy, did they see that? And they did. The movie revealed some things, even for me. When you put it in art, you can see it, not just read it, you can see it.
Do you think you're more proud of the movie or the grill?
You're obsessed with the grill. Let's see how the movie does first.
The movie is a wonderful experience, but that grill, I can jump up and have a burger, salmon, grilled salmon. Oh, boy, I love that grill.
The people from the movie company at the moment are going, say the movie, George, say the movie.
Okay, I forgot. The movie.
George, I think we've done pretty well. We didn't mention Muhammad Ali for 25 minutes and you mentioned him. Obviously, he plays a big part in your life story and in the film. How do you think the second George Foreman would have dealt with Muhammad Ali rather than the angry first incarnation of George? How do you think that would have gone?
Yeah, I fought the man and I tried to beat him up and everything. I tried. And of course, I lost the title. And when I lost the title, I was devastated. That's why I had so much vengeance, hate in my heart. I wanted to be champ of the world again. But just at the time when I could have, I found God. And in the meantime, I became friends. Muhammad started calling me. We became friends, talked on the phone. And then the iPhone, the advent of the iTelephone, where we can see one another as we spoke. I fell in love with Muhammad Ali.
Amazing. He
was one of the longest friends I've had, friendship I'd ever had. And I miss him to this day. I love the guy.
Oh, wow. Did you ever talk about parenting in the boxing circuit? Like, because obviously Muhammad Ali's got kids and it's such a macho world. Would you ever be like, oh, I'm having a bit of a nightmare, Muhammad, with my kid. She wants to stay out late. I don't know what to do. Did you ever have conversations like that?
You know, strange with Muhammad, he always wanted to win. Didn't realize how competitive he was. We talk on the phone, George, how many grandkids you have? I say, maybe three. Oh, I have five. Always wanted to win. And of course, both of us built our children were a greater part of our life than you could imagine. You grow up and you talk about what are you going to tell your kids? What are you going to teach them? The most important thing we both learned to teach our children is that we love them. No matter what someone does to them or say about them, they had us.
Because obviously you achieved so much in your life and your stuff. How did you deal with parenting kids there? Are you going, you can do all these things, or are you going, follow your own path? How do you deal with those kind of things with your kids?
Well, we built a big home with a lot of rooms, but I never displayed any of the world title belts and championships and trophies. I wanted them to know it was about them going out doing those things for themselves, not to try to compare themselves with their achievement with mine. And that was easy. My children learned to be themselves and not to be the child of George Foreman, but themselves. They were George Foreman. And I never did want them to say, oh, George Foreman's your dad. I wanted people to meet my children and say, and ask them their name. And they've done that. They've become great people with their own identity.
Yeah. But they are called George as well, George, which is a slight problem.
All of them, they're called George, but...
but they're their own people.
But you know what? They're their own person. Because George, my son George, he's proud of what he's accomplished. And you know, George, he's never offended by what George has accomplished. But that other George, I'm telling you, we've had some problems with. But then George straightens him out too.
So did the older kids start looking after the younger kids after a while then, like, and helping out with all the jobs?
Yeah, when you have so many kids, you can't make it without one looking after the other. They have their own thing together, the children. They are, even now, they have these chat lines where with sibling Jet. They still talk with one another. They have a life beyond George Foreman, the dad. They have their own lives, and I'm really happy about that.
And what were holidays like when you've got 10 kids? Where would you go? Would you stay at home? How did that work?
Well, you don't want to go out there and promote Christmas. Can you imagine buying 10 gifts for all of your children and then 15 for your grandkids? So what is best to do when those holidays come is disappear until it's all over.
So how does it work with, you say they've got like a big like group or like a WhatsApp group or whatever. Like, so do you have big family events? Is there like on your birthday or something? Is it just everyone comes to you and it's like kids everywhere? George is as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, their birthdays are more important to me than anything. When one of my kids have birthdays, we all try to be a part of it. My birthday is really special. They all try to decide what they're going to do for me. One year in particular, I told them, they were, what are we going to do for you? I said, I'd like to have just a birthday with nothing but my grandkids. And that was presented to me. None of the kids, just grandkids. That was probably the most wonderful birthday I ever had.
Oh, amazing.
Oh, amazing.
Being a grandparent, is that almost more rewarding than being a parent? Because obviously as a parent, you're having to discipline you, all those kind of things. As a grandparent, you can literally just be fun Grandpa George.
That's it. Being a grandfather is so rewarding. All you have to do is be nice. And they like you. I don't have to go out there and tell them, don't do this. Sit up straight. Be a bit, With the grandkids, all you do is just love them. And I think that's more rewarding to me. Or being a grandpa is no doubt one of the best things that ever happened to me.
So when you have all the grandkids over, and you, like you said, that was your favorite birthday, what do you do? Are they just watching telly or playing in the garden, or do you organize activities for them? What's your dream day with the grandkids?
Just sitting around in my big living room and watching them. They come by, take a picture or two. They tell jokes. They ask me something. I tell another joke. It's a joke telling time. But the most important thing is just sitting there watching them. And for some reason, they're entertained with it, too. I think they think, like I said earlier, they think I'm some big joker. So I love it.
You had a sitcom as well. So you are a big joke. Like, there was a George sitcom. Like, I mean, obviously, you've done everything in your life. Have they watched any of that? Do they go back and watch your old fights and stuff?
Yeah, some of the kids go back and they watch some of the old boxing matches because they didn't, especially grandkids, they didn't even know I was an athlete. Then each one of them get to a certain age where they turn on and say, that's George Foreman. And most of them even call me George Foreman, not even knowing that I was a boxer. And when they see me on television, there's George doing commercials. They've enjoyed it and come back and explain them, ask me questions about my life. The grandkids growing up, knowing their grandpa and asking questions is a wonderful thing.
And do you, obviously, you're a much happier George Foreman than the angry guy that burst onto the scene. Couldn't you still turn that on if you wanted to? I know you don't like to, but when your daughter started dating and the new boyfriend wasn't being very nice, have you still got it in your locker just to sort of turn up the scariness?
Well, I tell everybody, I went back to boxing the second time, and my theme was never a punch in anger. I never was angry. I never wanted to hurt anybody. I had to become champ of the world, but there was no anger, no hate at all. Now, when your kids, especially your daughter, start dating, I mean, you start putting this frown on your face, like, for the guys that know to bring those girls back home, I mean it. But other than that, I've had a lot of fun with it.
If you had that more, never throwing a punch in anger at the start of your career, do you think you would have beaten Muhammad Ali and carried on beating other people? Do you think you would have changed how you was as a younger fighter?
It would have been an asset. All of that anger didn't serve me well. I remember, even especially with Muhammad Ali, I was just trying to knock him out, beat him, knock him out of the ring. I didn't even care about strategy. For some reason, I wanted to get it over as quick as I could. Second time around, I really learned boxing as a skill. Anger was gone. I had to learn skill. I became better at it. If I had done that in the beginning, I never would have stopped boxing. 10 years out, I would have had 10 years to become a better boxer.
I mean, you so, must be so driven to do that twice. Do you see that in your, like, that's such a mindset? And obviously you came from a very different background to what your kids are coming from, because they're coming from, you know, the life of the world heavyweight champion and grill king. Is it difficult to keep them grounded in that sense, in the same way you were when you were coming up?
It's not easy. One morning, one of my boys, my first son, as a matter of fact, I heard him arguing with my wife, and she had some jeans. They were clean, but it seems to be they were looked faded. And I heard him say, "I don't want to look poor." I heard him. And I took him back to my neighborhood. I showed him the places where I tried to escape from police, where I live. He looked at me as like, "I don't think you're my dad." And so, because they had had such a good upbringing, everything they ever wanted, they had. And so that's why the movie, it made me happy, because they get a chance to see the real life of George Foreman and make them understand and appreciate their lives even more so than they did.
And have they seen the movie?
Yeah, the kid, they've gone to screenings of the movie and watched it one after another, and they come back and tell me, "I didn't know that. I didn't know that." A lot of things were cut out of the movie about my life, and I tell them, "I wish they had been cut out of my own life too." So let them go. Yeah.
You've had things in your life that haven't gone well for you, and then you've come back, like, you know, near-death experience, and that loss to Muhammad Ali was, you know, worldwide number one news at the time, and you were the new young thing. What advice would you give to people where the thing they wanted most hasn't gone for them, and it feels like it's the end, there's no other options of what to do? What advice would you give to someone, because you are the person that has come back and lived different lives? You haven't just done one thing. You've been liberated and tried that. What advice would you give to that person that's down at the moment thinking, "Oh, it's not gone my way"?
Yeah, what a wonderful chance to have a second chance at life. The most important thing, I wanted fame and wealth, and I had embraced all those things. And then I had a chance to lose them. And then that's when I found out the world was a better place. People would walk up to me and give me a boost on the car, and I try to pay them. They say, "Get out of here, biggin." They didn't even know me as George Foreman. Yeah. I found out that it was a better world even without all of that fame and fortune. And I appreciated life and friendship, forgiving. All of those things made for a better person. I learned to forgive. And once you forgive, you find out you got so many phone numbers that you can call and recall again. Yeah. that I had lost. And I tell people, it doesn't matter how far you fall, all you got to do is brush off your pants, spit in your palms, and go another round with life, because there's some great things around the corner for us if we just look for them. And boy, life has gotten better and better. And I tell people too, even now, put my both feet on the floor every morning and think, what's next? I got potential, you know. I feel that potential. There's a chance that I can do all things again. I'm always anxious to find different business. I don't want to be a boxer anymore. I don't want anybody hitting on me. But the point of it is, I still believe there's a future for me. I still believe.
Different wow. grill?
A different grill. Maybe the fat increasing machine, because now it's all about carbs are the bad thing, aren't they?
Give me ideas, I'll do it.
George, it's been so inspiring talking to you, and I think yeah. you're a great example of when what you could perceive as the worst thing to happen to you, which would have been, you know, the rumble in the jungle, losing that fight, was it feels like that was the best thing that happened to you, because it was the making of you. And then you had that night in Puerto Rico, and it changed everything. And that forgiveness and liberation has led to all these amazing things that you never could have imagined that first George Foreman would have gone on to achieve. It's quite remarkable.
Wow. Forgiveness is that subtle thread that binds both love and friendship. If you learn to forgive, if you without it, you could even lose children. You can be without a mother or father just because you don't forgive. I learned, and boy, I got 15 bank kids, 10 kids. Oh, I got it all now.
And you've got, hopefully, a number one film, George. This has been absolutely amazing. We've got one last question we always like to ask, which is, if your partner, your wife was listening to this, or your partner, what's one thing that your partner does parenting-wise that frustrated you over the years with the 10 kids? And what was the one thing she did that was like, ah, oh, she's so amazing, I'm so lucky to have children with her?
Oh, one thing, boy, that got me is my wife made out only the children behave. She started making me behave. Pick up those pants. You can't wear that shirt out there. And that was the most rough part of being married. But as life go on and you see your kids take on those little life lessons she's taught us, I'm glad that she was able to be the disciplinary person she was. I'm happy about that. It makes me love her more. She disciplined us all.
George, it's been a joy to speak to you. The film Big George Foreman, which is full of the, you know, the positivity that has welled through this interview, is out April 28th in cinemas. Yeah,
it's an amazing film, George. We're really proud. It's incredible, and you're an absolute inspiration. Thanks for letting us chat
thanks
to you.
Thanks so much for letting us chat to you.
And thanks for having me, guys.
I love that, Josh.
Yeah. Can we just say, for people who can't see it, pathetically, I'm wearing my wildcard boxing hoodie and Rob's got put a pair of boxing gloves behind
him. They're always
him.
There, to be
they're
honest.
They're not always there,
they
Rob.
Are always
they,
there.
They are not always
they
there.
Are. I've got a new camera, because that's why it, so it normally cuts
let's
off
let's go
there.
Back and check the footage. Let's go check back footage. And check the footage.
VAR. Now, what I wanted to say, though, because I'm not religious at all, but I totally do agree with that forgiveness thing. And being liberated, because I don't think you have to be religious to sort of believe in that. But and I think he's a great example of that, because if anyone was driven by anger and resentment more, it was George Foreman one. But then afterwards, he's become the most charismatic man I've ever met. Oh no, sorry, second behind Ali McCoist, who's also got five kids, five boys.
What's it going? What's going on there?
And my dad's got five boys. What a three!
Yeah, there you go. George Foreman, watch the film Big George Foreman, out April 28, as they say in America.
Yes, speak to you later. See you on Tuesday.
Bye.
I'm Ivo Graham.
And I'm Alex Keeley.
We're stand-up comedians who love music.
And we'd like to tell you about our new podcast, Gig Pigs.
Alex and I have been watching live music together for years, so we've decided to compromise this hobby, and potentially our friendship, by turning it into a project.
Every episode, we'll be going to a gig, and then discussing it afterwards with the friends who came along to third wheel us.
Asking questions like, did you enjoy the gig? Did you check the setlist in advance? Did you appreciate the artist's mid-song banter?
Did this gig profoundly change your relationship with live music?
Was the cloakroom queue prohibitively long?
We've been to Franz Ferdinand with Rose Matafeo and Emma City, Kendrick Lamar with Phil Wang, and The Cure with Cellier AB.
And next month, we're going with Ed Gamble to watch Napalm Death.
Episodes are out from this Thursday and every Thursday thereafter until attending live music once a week with a different guest becomes logistically impossible.
We have no idea how soon that could be, so join us now by going to your preferred podcast platform and searching Gig Pigs.
If you like Josh Widdicombe, you're in luck. That's because the co-host of Parenting Hell and The Last Leg Maestro is the guest on the first episode of the Always Be Comedy podcast. Out now, and with me, your host and MC at Always Be Comedy, James Gill. Each week, the cream of comedy curates their fantasy comedy gig. Who'd open? Who'd close? What gig nightmare do they never want to relive? All this and much, much more. It's essentially comedy gossip and chat.
You know, I remembered this the other day. My first ever gig. Oh, it was like a Friday night open mic night. And they said, we'll just announce you on when you're on. We haven't got a running order. It's a bit free form. I got to the end of the night and then they wrapped it up and they'd forgotten to put me on. Oh, and I'd sat there the whole night.
We've also got Stuart Lee, Harry Hill, Jen Brister, Ben Bailey-Smith, Maisie Adam, Al Murray, Rachel Paris, and many, many more coming up. That's the Always Be Comedy podcast, out now with new episodes every Tuesday.
If you are not in the queue and you are waiting, then step to the side.
He got in touch and said, yeah, sorry, mate, you didn't seem like yourself the other day. You've only met me 3 times.
The self-service checkouts. I don't care what you're called. I'm not getting tricked into working here.
People at festivals in those stupid jester hats.
I glanced at a tampon.
£2.69 for a bottle of water.
Why is your Wi-Fi
social
code
10
characters
long? The starts guiding
pencil.
You.
I don't care if
cut
your watch
jeans.
Boot cut jeans.
What's upset you now?
I'm Sean Walsh.
And I'm Paul McCaffrey. We are the hosts of What's Upset You Now?
The UK's angriest podcast.
And we are back for Series 5.
Booyah!
We all love a good moan, don't we? And Sean and I, well, Sean mostly, are two of the best in the absolute business. And every Tuesday and Thursday, we moan about all those little things that really get our goat. We also have guests. What guests have we had, Sean?
We have had Romesh Ranganathan, Rob Beckett, Mark Lamar, Joe Brand, Catherine Ryan, Tom Allen.
15-minute episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Brand new What's Upset You Now Series 5 out now.
Oh, for God's sake.